great rig, but, you know, one band not being able to do A2RIW, KC2FYJ.
KC2FYJ.
KC2FYJ, maybe you've used 1250 megs, and tell us anything you can about it. Go ahead.
Actually, no, I haven't, but I just checked the Limark website, and the 1288 repeater is still listed. It doesn't indicate whether it's active presently or not, but it's a W2VL repeater with an output on 1288, no shift, and a PL of 136.5, and it is in Glen Oak, assuming that it's up and running. But as I say, the website doesn't give a status.
You said no shift. What does that mean?
I'm not sure. I think that might be, you know, like the input-output shift, but it's... Oh, no, excuse me. It's a negative shift. Negative shift. I misread the screen. Negative shift. So the input is higher than the output.
Okay. So my main point is that the total amount of activity is rather light. The range is not as much as you'd like it to be. So... for the people who like working at microwave frequencies, it's sort of experimental. But you're not going to get on there at 3 o'clock in the afternoon, call CQ and get an answer, is my opinion now, Phil. KB2DXC for any other info, K2IW in the TechNet.
Our common tech. Ricky's comments are stupid.
Go ahead, Rich.
Okay. You can't use a vertical for sideband. Everything is horizontal, and you'll need some large beams. I was heavy into it when I lived in Whitestone. I had K, who is it? M squared. They make about the best. M squared. Had beams for 6, 2, 432, and 1296. 1296 about the only time I was able to make contacts was doing a VHF contest.
So, during the regular week without a contest, how many guys did you have to talk to? Two? My guess is it wasn't 20. Were there two other guys you could talk to, Rich? Go ahead.
On a regular day, nobody. Only on the VHF contest. 432, some people. I know Barry complains about the lack of activity on 432. Most of it is on 2 meters.
Hello, Barry. Please, Barry. Hello, Barry.
So as you can see, Phil, looks like the total amount of activity, even in the New York metro area, it's not great. And I think that's the information you were looking for. Back to you, Phil, for any of information. KB2DXC, K2RIW.
K2RIW, KB2DXC. That's pretty much what I figured. I mean, I looked at the repeater directory. You didn't see a heck of a lot in New York. California, loads of them. I have family out there. I might move out there sometime in the next few years. That's a little premature right now to use that as any kind of justification to spend money on big portion, which I probably couldn't do. Nice radio. I love it. Once again, spend that kind of money and have a big part of the radio and use. I thank you for your help and all the information from everybody else, including Y2H and O and whoever else was out there. Back to the group. And I thank you very much. K2RIW. K2.
Yeah, your audio is so low that you really got to be eating that microphone. And I can tell that as you talk, is sometimes moving your hand and the microphone goes in front of your mouth and not in front of your mouth. And when it's a little bit off to one side, we miss words that you're saying. So you really need a lot more audio on that rig. The deviation control has got to be set up quite a bit higher, Phil. Otherwise, you're not going to get very many answers when you're on the air. Okay, I think we've gone down the list of everyone who signed in. It's time to go over to Roy. AC2GS, Roy, with the science talk. And I've looked at the puzzle you're going to give us tonight, and there's an ambiguity when you said the pilots, when the planets are all lined up. Does that mean that in their normal orbit, you wait until that period of time, that they're all at the same solar azimuth angle, and Is that what you're saying? There's an ambiguity there with planets all lined up. AC2GS, K2RIW. Go ahead, Dr. Roy.
Yes, thank you very much, Dick. This I find it an interesting puzzle. It's kind of difficult semantically to explain to everyone, but before I get to the puzzle, and we'll get to it in a moment, I just want to once again remind people, if they have any mailbag questions for Dick that they can't tell him on the TechNet, you can email it to me. If you have any topics you would like me to cover, if there's any subject matters or questions, if you want to refute things that I said, feel free. The email address is, as always, mailbag@ac2gs.com. Again, mailbag@ac2gs.com. And everything that I talk about tonight will pretty much be posted 5-10 minutes after I'm done on my website, which is roy.ac2gs.com. I already have posted some pictures that Paul wanted me to put up that have to do with some stories that he's going to tell later on. And I also posted just a link to some very pretty astronomical photographs. Not going to really do any story on them, but I thought people might be interested in clicking them and taking a look at the pretty pictures. So let me drop, and I'll get on to my puzzle for tonight. Okay, the situation is I got myself a new toy, a little piece of software called Universe Sandbox, which gives you somewhat godlike powers. You can do almost anything with the universe. You can pick up planets, move them around. You can even throw them at other planets and see what happens. It's a pretty good planetary simulation. They cut a couple of corners because this isn't the supercomputer I'm using, but it's very pretty. So the puzzle for tonight is, we all know that the size of the universe, the size of the solar system, the size of planets is difficult for us to conceive of the enormity of everything. So the question is, if you were to, say, take the planet Earth and given godlike powers and forgetting about gravitational effects, you string planet after planet after the Earth so that they're just touching at their equatorial bulges, and you line them up like a string of pearls. When you get to the last planet, no matter what order you put them in, when you get to the last planet, what distance would that be in relation to the distance that our moon orbits the Earth? So the question is, Is it 10 times the distance between the moon and the Earth? Is it 50%, or is it possible that the moon would actually clear that entire string of all the planets in our solar system? So that's the question for tonight.
WB2GX.
Yes, Rich.
I will hazard a guess that the moon will clear all the planets. They are not going to be big enough diameter-wise in total to obstruct the moon's orbit.
Hey, Rich, that's a very good answer. Does anyone else have any answers?
KC2FYJ, and I agree with that answer.
Okay, very good, Harry. You agree with the answer. Anyone else who wants to say that they agree with the answer or has a slightly different answer or a completely different answer?
WS2N, I'll go with, I don't know, very close, within probably 5 or 10%. I don't know if it's going to hit the last planet, Pluto, or just miss it, but you're going to be right there.
Okay, so noted, Paul. Anyone else want to hazard a guess or make a statement about what they think the answer to this particular puzzler is?
KC2FYJ.
Harry.
Well, I gave my answer just based on thinking about it, but it's easy enough to figure out for sure. What you're asking, basically, is the sum of the diameter of all the planets in the solar system less than, equal to, or greater than the distance of the moon from the Earth. And, of course, the moon isn't in a completely circular orbit, so sometimes it's a little further away like it was two nights ago. But still, is the sum of all the diameters less than, equal to, or greater than the distance to the moon? And it's a fairly easy calculation to make.
Harry, it is, and I've done it just to double-check things, because I don't trust anyone on the web.
KD2NBB.
Bob.
Yes, Roy, I don't know off the top of my head, and I'm not looking it up, the diameters of all the planets, but judging that the moon is, like, sort of very roughly around 10 times the distance as the diameter of the... Oh, I'm sorry, never mind. It's going to clear them. I just realized I was thinking circumference. I'm going to say it's going to clear also, but I could be wrong. Anyway, back to you, Roy. I was thinking 25,000 miles for diameter, but it's actually a third of that, like 8,000. Back to you, Roy.
Okay, very good. Anyone else who want to hazard a guess or make a comment about it? I found this a fascinating type of a question. And it's a shame that I can't show you the graphic that I generated in this piece of software that just kind of brings it all together in a nice visual package.
You could use Snippet to make a screenshot and put it on your website.
Yes, I could do that, but unfortunately, it's kind of a really big image. And I'm already borrowing web space from a nice person who's letting me use their space. So I tend not to want to load up multi-megabit image files if I can spare him that. Also, you know, it's the moving image that I found really interesting to see everything spinning about. And that even takes up more megabytes of memory. Once again, before we talk about this with the answers available, anyone else with any comments or interjections or ideas on the subject?
And to Rio.
Richie.
Now, this is Bob, November Victor Bravo. I'm going to say that it won't clear. I think those planets like Jupiter and Saturn and Uranus and Neptune are a lot bigger than the Earth in diameter. So even though it's like 30 times or so more than the distance from the Earth's diameter, I'm going to just guess that the moon would hit them. Back to you, Roy.
Jupiter is about 1,100% the size of Earth, and Saturn is more than 900% the size of Earth. They're big planets. Richie, you also, I heard N2EO mention his call. So what do you have to say, Richie?
Okay, boy. Something I read recently on the Internet, take it for what it's worth, but some scientists believe they know why we have the 11-year sunspot cycle. They say it's because every 11 years, the planets line up. And when they line up, the gravitational pull, I don't know what the mechanism is, but brings up the sunspots.
Okay, Rich, I have never heard that. I don't think it happens at 11-year cycles, and the gravitational effect of all the planets in our lovely solar system probably have a quite negligible effect on the sun because of the incredible, ridiculous massiveness of it. But, okay, it's as good as anyone's idea.
I told you, Richie, you stupid!
KC2FYJ with a comment.
Harry.
Yeah, years and years ago, there was a book that came out called The Jupiter Effect, which postulated that when all the planets lined up, there, with Jupiter being at the heart of the line, that it was going to cause all kinds of havoc on the Earth for that very reason, gravitational effect. And in the year it was estimated to occur, nothing happened. They then later wrote another book called The Jupiter Effect, Why It Didn't Happen. So that situation is probably not related to the sunspot. And by the way, when all the planets are in a line like that, or three or four of them, they are referred to as being in syzygy, S-Y-Z-Y-G-Y, which happens to be a great word when you're playing hangman.
I agree with you. It is a great word, and one of the people who regularly emails me about questions for the TechNet has a name that's very close to syzygy, and I pointed that out to him in an email message a month or two ago. So that's a good little bit of trivia. And, yeah, I mean, you know, the world is always going to end. There's a Chicken Little every place, so I can understand why this, that, and the other thing will cause it to end. Unfortunately, someday something's going to happen that might cause it to end, and people will just be burnt out from all these previous threats on the universe and such. But, yeah, gravity is a very weak force, unfortunately. It's a universal force, and it kind of wins in the end because it has no boundary ranges. It can go as far as the end of the universe. Planets lining up isn't really going to do much to the planets. The gravitational field, certainly to the sun, it laughs at our gravity. It has much more gravity.
NWS2N.
Yes, Paul.
I'm looking at the diameter of the sun. I can see why you didn't use that one. We'd all be gobbled up. Okay. I'm not going to change. I'll stick with right at the very end, right where Pluto is sitting on top of Neptune. I think the moon's going to be sitting on top of Pluto.
And once again, I will ask people if they have any other input that they would like to make at this point in time. Any guesses or clever ideas that they would like to propose? Heard a carrier under me. I may have been doubling with someone. If I am, I'm sorry. Please, if you have a statement to make, make it. One last time, I'll ask if anyone has any comments or suggestions or opinions, and then I'll move on to the explanation.
Hey, Roy, maybe we weren't supposed to include Pluto. It's not a planet, right?
Yeah, Pluto isn't considered in this because it's not a proper planet, unfortunately. And we have to go with the accepted nomenclature. So, yeah, it doesn't include Pluto in this mathematics. And I didn't do the math for Pluto, so I don't know if Pluto screws everything up or not. I doubt it.
Okay, there goes 1,500 miles out the window.
Hey, once again, anyone with any other comments on this particular puzzle?
That Pluto is stupid.
Hey, so we'll go to the answer, and a lot of people kind of came very close and sort of mentioned it, but didn't really kind of get into it, but probably was thinking of it and sort of knew the answer. The unfortunate reality is it sort of clears the planet, but it depends. As someone mentioned, it's an elliptical orbit. It has a perigee of about 224,000 miles, and it has an apogee of 251,655 miles. Now, at the apogee, it clears all those planets. At the perigee, unfortunately, it doesn't. It knocks the last planet in its face. No matter what you do, you can't fit all the planets in our solar system in the perigee. You can, however, fit it in the mean orbit if you are able to really do amazing things with planets, if you can turn them 90 degrees, because most of the planets have a fast rotation that causes their equatorial diameters to be wider than their polar. If you can flip their equatorial to their polar, the way that you're stringing together the planets, you can line them up and they will be shorter than the mean orbit of the Earth and the Moon. But even if you do that, you're not going to come to the lunar perigee of 224,000 miles. So that's the story. I sort of found it amazing. You tend to think that planets are enormous. You tend to think that the Moon is next door. But it's far away. Distances and sizes, we have no sense of what they really are, unfortunately. They're so enormous out there. So I thought it might interest people, this little puzzle.
Envoy, I have a simple question. Unrelated, maybe you want to take it later.
Well, I'll ask if anyone has any comments to make about this puzzle, and if no one has any comments, I'll let you ask your question. So if anyone has any kind of statements or questions or wants to refute me, feel free. Now's the time. Okay, I guess it's your turn, Richie. What's your question for tonight?
Okay, a simple medical question, and not about me. I'm not asking that. I was recently told that a cat does not need a shot for feline leukemia because he does not go out. He's a house cat. I don't know if that's right or wrong. Whenever I had a child, I was misdiagnosed with leukemia. A blood test created up to be false. Do you develop leukemia, or is it something you catch?
Leukemia isn't the same in human beings and in cats. Feline leukemia is caused by a retrovirus that infects cats, and as a side effect produces what's called feline leukemia. Leukemia in human beings is not believed to be due to a viral infection, and therefore there is no vaccination against leukemia. It's produced by all the other mutagenic materials, radiation exposure and such in our environment. There's some genetic predisposition to a degree, but there's no indication that it's due to a viral infection.
Okay, do you think that, in your opinion, because he doesn't go out, he's a house cat, he does not need a feline leukemia injection?
Now, I'm not a veterinarian. I didn't really study or practice veterinary medicine, so I don't really know. I could understand the veterinarian's attitude that if it's purely a home living cat, it has much lower risks. I don't know if the vaccine has any risks of its own. If it does, I guess there's a reason to forestall it. But, I think it probably could go either way. But once again, I am not a veterinarian.
Okay, boy. Well, thank you for your input. I'm going to make some more checks with other vets. That's all. Thank you for your advice. M2EO.
Okay, very good, Rich. Anyone else with any topics or questions before I move to the first story? This one, I am going to attempt something that some people have suggested might not be a good thing to attempt, but I'm going to try anyway because I'm feeling lucky tonight. But if anyone has any particular questions or such, you can ask me at this point. Blue. I don't hear you. I'm sorry, maybe if you move the antenna around. By the way, a gentleman in Echolink, Robert from, New Zealand, asked me what's the name of the program. The name of the program that I've been playing with is called Universe Sandbox. So I hope he heard that. I'll type it in if I get a chance on the Echolink text. But, Lou, if you kind of move or wiggle your antenna someplace different, maybe I can hear you. Right now, you're 99% noise.
Is this better?
It's a little bit better. Now you're 50% noise.
All right. I posted in the chat room a link to the theory about the planets being aligned in the sunspot cycle. Only three planets are involved. There's something called the Taylor effect. It has a very similar title. And they get into it pretty deeply, and they show you how the effect can occur even though it doesn't penetrate into the center of the sun or anything like that. So there's a link there. You might want to review it, maybe comment on it next week.
Okay, very good, Lou. I will, you know, when I get done with this thing, I kill the window, and right behind it, once again, is the chat room conversation, and so I'll cut and paste it, and I'll take a look at it, and say some words about it next week. I think it's a little too glib a reason. It kind of assumes that we have the faintest clue what's going on the sun, and I'm sort of amazed at what little we do know about the sun we've been able to figure out. But there's still a lot of big questions, you know, like why the temperature goes up from the surface above it, goes up to millions of degrees and such. That still hasn't been solved completely. But I'll read that article. Thank you very much, Lou.
Yeah, okay. Reserve your comments until you read. They correlated this over many cycles, so there might be something to it. We'll find out next week. I have YQHD.
Okay, very good, Lou. Anyone with any topics before I move on to my next, I think, very interesting story?
WS2N, I'm reading Lou's link now. Pretty good.
Okay, very good. I mean, I wish I could multitask that well, where I could do this and read simultaneously. It's something, I guess, to aspire to in the future.
I thought you were always doing that.
It is surprising the number of things I simultaneously tend to do in front of my computer in my shack. Right before this, while I was monitoring Echolink and the chat room and listening to the program, some lady in upstate New York was sending slow scan TV images for an art exhibit that she's doing, and I received them and cut and pasted them into a mail client and send them off to her. So I can do five or six things simultaneously, but talking on the radio kind of limits me to one thing.
Very well done, Roy. Okay, go on.
Okay, I just want to apologize to Robert. I, for some odd reason, thought he was from New Zealand. He is from Sydney, Australia. So thanks for listening to us, Robert, and I hope you take a look at the program. I found it endlessly amusing. You need a bit of a good graphics card to get it to run fast, but otherwise it's loads of fun to play God with the universe. Anyway, let me drop, and I will go on to my first subject for tonight. Okay, here, if you will, is my dubious attempt to explain why a magnetic field may just be an electric field from a different frame of reference. And as well, an electric field may just be a magnetic field from another frame of reference. Or, like Albert Einstein is believed to have said, it's all relative. Now, all characters in this next theoretical construct are purely fictitious and are not related to any person listening to this attempt on my part here. Okay? Joe is standing in a non-conductive windowless enclosure with a rocket engine, and all the mechanics stowed below a well-insulated soundproof floor, which is accelerating him and his enclosure at a constant acceleration of 9.8 meters per second squared. Joe is soaring out of our solar system at a constant acceleration of 9.8 meters per second squared, and he is carrying an electrostatically charged sphere. I mean, who doesn't travel with a charged sphere these days? Now, with the surrounding electric field, as we all know, charged particles behave differently whether they are at rest, moving at a constant velocity, or accelerating. Now, all charged particles at rest produce an electric field excitation. All charged particles traveling at a constant linear or angular velocity produce a magnetic field excitation. And all charged particles traveling at an always changing velocity or accelerating produce an electromagnetic field excitation. Let me drop for a sec. Now, Joe and his electrostatically charged sphere are accelerating, but is that charged sphere radiating any electromagnetic waves or not? Now we have Paul traveling in another rocket ship, which is traveling at a faster relative velocity, but is also accelerating at 9.8 meters per second squared. As Paul passes Joe's rocket, he measures the area for any field excitation. Now, Dick, at his observation point at Artemis Moon Base, watches both rockets fly past and points his own measuring device. What field excitations do these scientists see when they compare notes? According to Einstein's equivalence rule, as explained in his general theory of relativity, the effect of gravitation is locally equivalent to the acceleration of an observer. So Joe should not be able to tell whether he is inside his rocket ship or inside his windowless radio shack at home. There is no piece of equipment that he can take into his enclosure that would give him the faintest clue whether he was on a rocket or right at home. What about Paul from his relative greater velocity, or Dick from his perspective watching Joe accelerate past his measuring equipment? Can Joe use the behavior of his electrostatically charged sphere to violate Einstein's equivalence rule? So let's plant Joe definitively back in his radio shack, surrounded by the Earth's gravitational field. That should be equivalent to a net acceleration for him of 9.8 meters per second squared. Is his ever-present electrostatically charged sphere radiating any electromagnetic waves into his environment, anywhere, anywhen? That's a kind of the premise of how magnetism and electrical charge are kind of relativistic two sides of the same exact coin. Anyway, I will post a interesting video on YouTube that goes into this concept a little bit in a different way. But that's my little two cents on relativistic electrodynamics, or how electric fields and magnetic fields and electromagnetic fields are somewhat the same thing with just different frames of reference.
KC2FYJ with a comment.
Harry.
Well, it seems to me, thinking about this, that from Joe's perspective, inside this windowless room, in the rocket ship, accelerating at 9.8 meters per second squared, the sphere and Joe are not moving at all with relation to each other, so for him, it'll be an electric field. But for Paul, who's moving at a different speed, that sphere is accelerating, and so it should be an electromagnetic field. That's just what initially crosses my mind. And they'll see it differently because of their different frame of reference, which is more or less what Einstein was saying to begin with.
Pretty good, Harry, and that's sort of what I'm trying to get at, but I would adjust it a little bit. Paul is traveling at the same acceleration. He just started off at a higher speed. So as far as the two of them, it's a constant velocity difference. So they're not, he's not accelerating. He just has a different relative, constant relative velocity to Joe. It's Dick, who's on the moon, that sees both these guys zipping through accelerating.
You're right. I picked the wrong name. My apologies.
No, it's fine that you're participating in this. I mean, that's the thing that kind of made me feel very, very weird about the whole darn thing. From Joe's perception, it is an electrostatic charge. From Paul's perception, it is a magnetic field excitation. From Dick on Moonbase, it's an electromagnetic phenomena. So that's the gist of how relativistic electrodynamics is different than classical, where there's electrical fields, there's magnetic fields that are right angles of each other, and they're two completely separate things, even though they go arm in arm. In relativistic electrodynamics, they are, you cannot separate one from the other. They are always together. It's the same way that ellipses in extreme cases in one direction can be a straight line, and ellipses in extreme cases in the opposite direction can be a perfect circle. So they're just two sides of the same coin, or at least that's what I got out of reading relativity.
This is KC2FYJ with a suggestion for you.
Sure, Aaron. Give me a suggestion.
I don't know if you've ever seen it or not. If you have not, I recommend highly the book called Why Does E Equal MC Squared and Why Should We Care? It's a layman's presentation that tries to explain a lot of the peculiarities of Einstein's theory of relativity, and it does an extraordinarily good job of it.
Hey, very good, Harry. Thank you very much. I will Google it. I will go to Amazon and see what it looks like. And I think about 4 or 5 months ago, I mentioned the fact that although E equals MC squared is a nice, elegant equation, it's not the complete equation because it's a special case for objects that are at rest. If the object is not at rest, there is an additional momentum term in that energy equation.
That may be. I'm not a relativistic physicist by any stretch. But the book is an extremely good layman's presentation. And it starts out presenting the optical clock that you may have heard of. And this shows why time speeds up and slows down depending on whether you're moving or not. It's fascinating to read and think about.
Okay, I will certainly take a look at it. A lot of stories of the physicists in the turn of the century, especially a lot of this work was being done in Europe, most of it in Germany, and there were some other countries. The stories kind of always seem to include trains. It seems like these guys were spending a way large amount of their lives traveling back and forth to places on trains, and a lot of their eureka moments came while they were sitting in a train looking out the window. And Einstein had his story. Max Planck had his story. It's interesting how trains seem to be involved in turn-of-the-century physics back then.
Well, no more so than rockets in modern-day puzzles. It was the main mode of transportation.
Guess so, but, you know, I mean, you had back in ancient Greece where the guy got his idea when he was in the bathtub, apparently. I don't know. That strikes me as a little apocryphal.
I doubt we'll ever know the truth of that one. That was the Archimedes Eureka moment. This is KC2FYJ, and I'll sit back on the side now.
NWS2N.
Call.
So based on what you're saying, I'm looking at it another way. Let's say you had a wave, either a light wave or a radio wave, and that person goes at the same speed as that wave, which is, you know, the speed of light. And you're going along next to it, and you're looking at the electric portion of the electromagnetic wave. And you caught up to it, and it's like standing still. So let's not use a light wave; it's too small. You know, we don't want to go down to nanometers. So maybe a 40-meter wave or something, or a 20-meter wave. So you're actually next to this wave, and you know, visually you can see it, and you're looking at the electromagnetic wave. Now another guy is right near you, but he's 90 degrees away from you, looking at his wave, and which would normally, you know, as far as the other guy, he's concerned, that would be the magnetic wave. Are you saying that other guy is now seeing an electric wave? You know, therefore a magnetic wave maybe not, doesn't even exist as far as both people are concerned. They're both going at the same speed, as you know, following this wave along. Back to you, Roy.
The only way you could really kind of play this relativistic game is to use the radiator as a source, not the actual field. Because you get into a lot of problems if you try and use the field. If you try and use the electromagnetic field, you're traveling at the speed of light. Now, since you have a non-zero rest mass, this is already an impossibility. Also, as you approach the speed of light, both time and space itself warp. So directions, the length of directions contract, distorting everything. So there are so many theoretical problems with traveling with a light wave. The problem with, well, not the problem, but one of the natures of relativity is if you had it's a non-Newtonian, non-additive velocity. So in Newtonian physics, if you travel on a train that goes 100 miles an hour and you throw a ball from it that's going 20 miles an hour, from the tracks, it looks like the ball is going 120 miles an hour, and that's Newtonian physics. The problem is, in relativity, it doesn't work like that at all. If you travel at half the speed of light and turn on a flashlight, the light going away from you is traveling at the speed of light. You could travel as fast as you want, but that light is still traveling at the speed of light because that's the only speed it can travel at. So that's one of the gotchas with relativity.
Okay. I guess we can't use that theory. I was trying to use that theory to support K2RIW's theory about possibility of maybe an electric field doesn't even exist. Everything's magnetic field. But, okay. Yeah, things change when you get to the speed of light. Okay. I gave it a shot. Back to you, Roy.
I mean, basically, relativity gives you the concept that a coin has a head and a tail. It's very difficult to have just a head. I mean, you can probably mint one with two heads, but it still has two sides to it. So you'd have to think in some terms of a coin that only has one side. That would be a very, very strange geometrical coin.
KC2FYJ, not really. You just take a coin, stretch it into a Mobius strip, and print a head on it. And it's just going to have a head. That's it.
Okay, but to me, using a Mobius strip as a coin would be a very, very bizarre coin indeed.
VDH with a comment.
Yes, John.
With regard to WS2N's comment, a quick way to remember that is that the velocity of propagation of light is the constant, independent of the velocity of the source or the observer. And that's how you can sort of keep those things in mind.
You could use that. You could use that. The speed of light in a vacuum is an absolute number. What some people kind of take away from that is that it's a quality inherent in light itself. According to good old Albert, it's more of a quality inherent in space-time. Space-time has a causality speed limit. Cause and effect can only be transmitted through space-time at a maximum velocity of the speed of light. So gravity also travels at the same speed of light. Anything that has a very, very fast, unlimited speed is limited by space-time itself, and that leaves you with the speed of light in a vacuum.
Yeah, and it also works out in that it rules out the example of a spot of light being swept across the moon by a rotating device rotating at 1 radian per second, because it would sweep a spot of light across the moon at 240,000 miles per second, which is not actually propagating. Go ahead.
We got into that about a year ago as a misunderstanding of what's going on. The light from your laser pointer is not going from one side of the moon to the other side. All these lights are traveling from your laser printer up and at the moon in different directions. So that's not a velocity of the photons striking the moon. That's just a change in your direction.
Yeah, nothing is actually propagating across the moon. The direction of propagation is from Earth to moon. It is not propagating across the moon. Good.
I totally agree with you. Matter of fact, that kind of leads to a little bit of confusion. If you ever look up the diameter of an electron in some Wikipedias and other such, they have a very strange entry for the diameter of an electron. They usually say less than, and then they give you a measurement, which is the smallest measurement an experimental science can possibly detect. And that's because probably it's a point source. It's a single non-dimensional charged particle, which is deeply confusing to everyone, including myself. But if you think of it, if it wasn't the case, if orbital spin, which is a quantum term that really doesn't have to do with spin, mechanical spin that we think of, if it did have the mechanical spin that we conceive of, the velocity of a near point electron would violate the speed of light. So that's another little strange thing about the speed of light telling us that we're looking in the wrong direction.
Roy, WS2N.
Yes, Paul.
I read a lot of books and articles that say that the electron is 1,800 of the of one proton. So, you take a proton, divide that by 1,800, and that's the size of the electron. So is that all wrong?
Word, yeah, it's wrong, unfortunately. What happens is the way that we're able to measure the size of things, there's no good way yet to measure something with a zero diameter. So what happens is the laboratory equipment has accuracy to a certain point. That point is what is usually published. Depending upon what decade, the equipment gets a little bit better, so the less than size for the electron gets smaller and smaller every decade. I think because ultimately it is a dimensionless fundamental particle. Protons and neutrons aren't. They're complex particles. They're made out of three quarks, which are which are dimensionless themselves. But when you put three dimensionless objects together in a group, you get all the three dimensions of height, width, and depth. So protons and neutrons definitely have diameters. I think they're going to find that electrons don't. But some sources weasel it and say it's less than 10 to the minus whatever that week. But no, you can't really say that it's a certain percentage of a proton or a neutron, unfortunately. Although I'm sure at one point that's what they wrote in books.
Okay, thanks for that.
Okay, very good. Anyone with any other comments about my proposition about the electromagnetic spectrum? Otherwise, I'll move on to another story.
I have a question about time, and I think it relates to relativity and to you.
Okay, Richie, what about time?
Okay, myself and Barry had a long discussion one time. Are we moving forward in time, or is time moving backwards? And we think we're going forward in time. Also, there's some thought, I don't know what you think, about particles of time.
Well, time may be granular, the same way that quantum mechanics basically sets finite units for everything. It is possible that space itself is quantized, that there are Planck lengths that you cannot get smaller than that. The fabric of space-time becomes deeply confusing below a Planck's length. And there are also such things as Planck time, that cause and effect don't make any sense less than a Planck second, if you will. So it's possible that time and space itself is granular, is pixelated, is infinitesimal units that you can't cut in half. That's a good theory that's been promoted repeatedly. As far as where we're going through time, I kind of believe in the basic concept that we're traveling forward. There's an arrow of time where entropy increases. That tends to be called the second law of thermodynamics, and it seems to work. Things always go towards a more disordered system, and that's what time is to a degree, and the arrow is always pointing into the future. Sometimes they have wonderful philosophical discussions that antiparticles, that a anti-electron called the positron, it can be defined as an electron that's going backwards in time. But that doesn't quite mean that that's really what's going on. It just means that it's an interesting trick of the mathematics involved in quantum mechanics that you can describe a positron as an electron going backwards in time. I still think that we're in a stream that only goes in one direction, personally. I don't think we can travel into the past. I think we can travel into the future. I mean, we do it every second of our lives. And depending upon our relative velocities and our accelerations, we can change the rate that time passes for us as opposed to other people. You have things like the twin paradox, where there are two twins born on the Earth. One twin takes a trip on a rocket ship at near relativistic speeds and then turns around and comes back. And for him, only about 10 years has passed, but his poor twin brother has died of extreme old age. So time can speed up forward, but I don't think it can reverse.
Wesley next.
Hey, Wesley, recognize. Richie, did I answer your question?
Yes, you did. I don't believe we can go back, but I believe we can go forward. We know that from space travel, and maybe we can accelerate. I don't know. Last question concerning the same subject. at what speed do they believe the universe is expanding? At 300 meters per second, or what?
Well, it depends on what you're looking at. That's the whole concept the farther you look, the faster it's traveling away from us, and we don't know how far the edge, if there is an edge of the universe, exists, because we can only see things that can travel to us at the speed of light in the last 13.8 billion years. So it's within the realm of possibility that there's other stuff outside the observable universe that's still our universe that's traveling a lot faster than we have any idea. The edges of the universe are probably traveling faster than the speed of light. And you might ask me, how the heck could it do that? Because nothing can travel faster than the speed of light. But you have to understand that the universe is not just kind of traveling, it's actually expanding. And space-time can expand at any rate that it wants to. It's not limited by its own kind of speed limit within space-time. So it could be traveling close to an infinite amount of speed at the edges, for all we know. We don't know if the real, if the total universe is twice the size of the observable universe that we can see, or whether it's a trillion, trillion, trillion times bigger than the observable universe that we can see.
Okay, fine, boy. Well, it's interesting. If the universe is expanding faster than the speed of light, that leaves open a very interesting many other theories. I've never been a believer, it never can happen, never say never. When I always get back to my example that when the Wright brothers built their airplane, everybody laughed at them. They thought they were crazy because man couldn't fly. Maybe we can exceed the speed of light. We just don't have the technology and knowledge at this time.
Oh, Richie, it makes for excellent science fiction, because science fiction would be very boring if it took multiple lifetimes to get to the closest star system. So thank God for Star Trek, the warp drive, and what have you. The problem is, once again, that things in the universe are not traveling faster than the speed of light. The universe itself is expanding faster than than the speed of light, which is a different thing entirely. So the universe that may very well be traveling at multiple times the speed of light is not violating relativity. It's simply going around it to something completely different. That the fabric of space-time can expand at any rate that it wants to. There is no inherent limitation in the expansion of space-time. What there is a limit is in getting a cause and effect through space-time itself to go any faster than the speed of light.
Okay, what we're just saying is very, very interesting. Very interesting. Is that quantum mechanics or what? And then I'm going to leave you. I'll be back in a little while. And to Rio.
Most of this is relativity, which is a little bit different than quantum mechanics. There's a bit of quantum mechanics thrown in, but most of this is based on Einstein's general and special theory of relativity.
KC2FYJ was a thought.
Yes, Harry.
Given the premise that the universe has a finite amount of mass, is it not reasonable to suppose that the universe exists as a black hole to someone on the outside of the universe? Even if it is expanding, that's an event horizon that's expanding that we could never get beyond.
Yes, that is I don't know if I'd call it a popular theory, but it's certainly a well-known, popularized theory what we're calling a universe is actually to other things outside of it, whatever that might mean, is a black hole. Another one that probably gives me a much worse migraine.